Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm Adam Woodward.
And I'm Caitlin Quinlan.
On the show this week, Bond is back for Craig's last stand in No Time to Die. We're also reviewing the small-budget skydiving drama Anne at 13,000 Feet. And in Film Club, we're going back to 1983 for Sean Connery's final off-brand appearance as James Bond in Never Say Never Again. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. This week's episode of Truth and Movies is sponsored by Terra Virtua, the world's first fully immersive social digital collectibles platform. Terra Virtua is an entertainment-focused collectibles platform. Using blockchain technology, it allows collectors of digital assets to display and interact with their virtual goods in augmented reality, virtual reality, and in 3D on PCs. Leveraging the latest in mobile and gaming technologies, their mission is to engage and connect fan-based user communities and turbocharge fandom. Head to terravirtua.io, that's TerraVirtua.io, to find out more. Yes, welcome back, listeners, and welcome back, Adam. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. How are you doing, Adam?
Pretty good. I've been looking forward to this all week, I've got to say. It was super fun seeing a big film in a big cinema again, and it felt like a proper event, a proper experience. So yeah, quite excited to talk about it.
Oh, terrific. And Caitlin, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome back. I think this is the first time you've been on since we've revamped in 2021. Could you please reintroduce yourself to us and the listeners?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back. I'm Caitlin Quinlan. I'm a film critic from London, a regular Little White Lies contributor. You can find me in the mag and online a fair bit. So yeah, always a pleasure to be on the podcast as well.
Yeah, you've been off in sunnier climes, haven't you, recently on the festival circuit?
We have. Both Adam and I had the pleasure of being in San Sebastian for the festival, which was just a dream. I mean, like, what a place to have a film festival. It's, you know, by the sea, it's warm, the food's amazing. Yeah, had a great time out there.
What's the vibe in San Sebastian? What sort of films do they play? Is there a certain genre or whatever that they showcase?
It's quite a mix, I think. They have a lot of, you know, obviously like Basque films, and they focus a lot on Spanish language cinema, which is great. But, you know, really it's kind of a mixture of films that have been at other festivals before and ones that have sort of managed to find a home in San Sebastian. So, yeah, we saw some great kind of, you know, Chinese sort of police noirs and like Korean coming of age dramas, just a total mixture.
Any very quick titles we should be looking out for that might finally make it over here eventually?
Well, Adam actually recommended this one to me, which is the police drama Fire on the Plane, which hopefully we'll see some release somewhere. I don't know. We'll find out. But I was a big fan of that one. And also a Netflix film by Tatiana Huezo, which was at Cannes, called Prayers for the Stolen. Definitely one to keep an eye on.
Adam, any highlights from you?
Yeah, I saw they had a really cool retrospective on like Korean cinema from the 60s that had been all kind of restored, and all had like amazing titles like Aimless Bullet and things like that. And there's I think the most famous one probably of the ones they had there was called The Housemaid, which you may have seen, but it's like it's a real clear influence on Parasite. Really, really good. And then also Terence Davies' Benediction. Looking ahead to kind of newer releases, which is going to be at London Film Festival quite soon. Really amazing film. And actually, maybe we'll come on to this a bit more later, but I'm going to kind of pin my colours to the mast now and say Jack Loudon, 007. Make it happen.
Okay, yeah, we'll have to talk over that very shortly. I always find San Sebastian quite a funny one, because that seems to be the last film festival of the summer, and it happens 1 week before, or 2 weeks before, the London Film Festival, which feels like the first festival of the winter. It's much, much greyer and colder affair. But the films this year are fantastic. We'll be talking more about the London Film Festival next week, I believe, on the podcast. But for now, you two have been international jet sets. So, of course, we should talk about the ultimate international jet set hero, James Bond, finally making it to our screens in No Time to Die. In No Time to Die, Bond has left active service and is enjoying a tranquil life in Jamaica. His peace is short-lived, however, when his old CIA friend Felix Leiter turns up asking for help. The mission to rescue a kidnapped scientist turns out to be far more treacherous than expected, leading Bond onto the trail of a mysterious villain armed with dangerous new technology. So, Adam, this has been a long, long, long delayed Bond film. So my sort of hype levels have been all over the place. Should we be excited for this one? Did it reach the hype levels that we should expect?
Yeah, it's funny you say they've been all over the place, because I've kind of gone a bit back and forth on this one myself. And I think like, you know, pre-pandemic, in a kind of normal circumstances, any new Bond film is an event. I think this, The kind of extended delay, and we should say not just the pandemic, but before that, there was like a change of director and other kind of things which delayed the production. So it really has been a long time coming. I think possibly the longest pause or gap between Bond films ever,
right?
Something like 6 years. And I don't know whether it's helped or hindered the film in terms of anticipation. And I was also a little bit worried that it would be somehow or would feel somehow a little bit, I don't know, like possibly dated somehow, like with the storyline. I mean, I don't think that actually, thankfully, came to pass. I think it actually feels like a very modern Bond film. And it doesn't feel like a film which was made 2 or 3 years ago. And it was, as I said earlier, it was amazing to go back to a big press screening, and actually see a film like this in that context, in that environment. And it is, I must say, it really is a film which is kind of made for the big screen. I think it's the first Bond film shot on like 65mm Panavision and IMAX cameras. So the action scenes, and you can kind of look out for it, but you'll see when it goes IMAX, it's like pretty impressive. I think Cary Fukunaga, the director, and his production team have really delivered on that sense. I mean, this is kind of being touted as the film that is going to like save or kind of get people back at least to the cinema, right? Because for those people who maybe only go a handful of times a year, Bond is like one of the things they will go back for. So it is a big deal. And I think I would say, you know, we'll get onto this in a bit more detail, but I'm a little bit mixed on the film itself. But I think everyone should go and see it. It is a proper, you know, proper event, proper good big screen experience.
Yeah. Caitlin, are you a Bond fan? Are you up to speed with Bond? Just so we're all introduced, were you excited for this one?
I admittedly, I'm not a huge Bond fan. I have seen maybe two of the other Daniel Craig Bonds. I definitely haven't seen the one that preceded No Time to Die. Bond is just something to me that is, you know, incredibly formulaic and incredibly structured in such a way that I feel like even if I've only seen one, I've seen them all. And I know sort of to aficionados of Bond, that's maybe, you know, heresy to say, but I just know what I'm getting in for. It's exciting in lots of ways. It's fun in lots of ways. But I don't necessarily feel like I've missed out on a whole load by not having seen every single Bond movie ever made. Having said that, it was very exciting, as Adam says, to be back, you know, in a massive IMAX screen, you know, surrounded by people who were clearly like palpably very excited to see this film. And it felt like a massive event and an occasion, which was, you know, it's always fun to be around that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the aficionados would be too bent out of shape by that, because I think that's part of the fun of Bond, isn't it? Where you have the pre-title sequence, the gun barrel sequence, the song, yeah, the gun, the car, the etc. It's part of the fun. But I suppose then it's about balancing, giving us what, you know, giving the fans what they want, what they expect, but then also judging it up in some way, Adam.
I think this is where I sort of sympathise with the screenwriters and the producers of these films, because, you know, they're kind of damned if they do, damned if they don't, in the sense that people, and when I say people, I mean like snooty critics like myself, are kind of constantly calling for these films to kind of do something a bit different or take the character in a different direction. And then, you know, I think there is a kind of push and pull there between how, or like to what extent do you do that and risk essentially upsetting the like loyal fan base? Does it really matter that much? Maybe that's something we'll come on to. Like, I think these films maybe take themselves a little bit too seriously sometimes, and the whole conversation around them, which is, you know, it itself just kind of dominates the headlines in between these films kind of coming out. Talk will invariably turn to, you know, who will kind of inherit the license to kill next. And I mean, I've already sort of waded into that, but I just feel like, you know, it is a time for a bit of a hard reset for this franchise now. And you know, I feel like they've really quite definitively drawn a line under the Craig era with this. Maybe for better or worse. I think there'll be like purists who will say that it maybe flouts the kind of golden rule of Bond by, you know, without spoiling anything. I think this film kind of treats the actor who is playing the character as bigger than the character. Mm. And I was a little bit confused with this, you know, to what extent are we supposed to be honouring and saying goodbye to Daniel Craig's Bond or the actor himself? It's a bit of a strange, I don't think the film really quite gets that right. And I think it will maybe like rankle a few people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's also the thing that they can just do the stock storylines and characters and cliches, and there's a familiarity with it that people like yourself, Caitlin, who maybe haven't seen, you know, that many, or haven't even seen the last one. I mean, I actually would say this film and the whole Craig era of Bond, it did break tradition initially, or certainly with Casino Royale and them, and then Quantum of Solace, by essentially being like a serialized continuous story, right? It wasn't the case before that. I mean, even I think the Brosnan era, there's a few callbacks and obviously references and throwbacks to older Bonds, but essentially they are like standalone movies. And this is like an arc. And I think they kind of almost wrote themselves into a corner with that. And actually, David Jenkins, our August colleague, was sort of comparing this after the screening to Rian Johnson's The Last Jedi, in terms of what it does, in terms of like possibly maybe upsetting some of the hardcore fan base. But I actually think it's a little bit more similar to the film which followed that, Rise of Skywalker, because essentially what it does is tries to like unright some of the wrongs of Spectre, the previous film, which, you know, was pretty well received at the time, but I think now people regard as like the lesser, you know, down there with kind of Quantum of Solace. So yeah, it's interesting. I think this film possibly raises more questions than it answers. It's quite a satisfying conclusion to the Craig era if you're a really big fan of the Daniel Craig Bond, but I don't think it's a particularly great Bond film in the traditional sense.
That's really fascinating. I love how invested you are in Bond stuff, Adam. Caitlin, as somebody who's
I've got to say.
No, this is a surprise. Whenever Bond comes along, Adam, you pull out. You've got the knowledge there.
Do you know what? I've just like, I wouldn't ever say I'm a like major Bond head, but I have seen all the films and I did grow up watching them.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of just, they're very much like, they've seeped in over the years and I can kind of, you know, refer to them, and I do have a kind of sense of the bigger picture of it, I guess.
Yeah, all those bank holidays add up, don't they? But Caitlin, as somebody who's a bit, maybe a bit more casual and the approach to Bond. What's your take on Daniel Craig, this being his last hurrah?
Yeah, I mean, I think I really agree with what Adam was saying, you know, even as someone who maybe doesn't have the knowledge to that extent, but it was very clear to me in this film that, you know, the film was much more about the ending than it was about the logic of getting there. So I found that as a standalone film, you know, I had problems with the storyline. I had problems with the kind of like gravity of the villain, which didn't really feel to me like someone who kind of merited the power that he was granted by sort of the end of the film. And it felt very much like this whole film was working towards this great send-off for Daniel Craig, which I understand. I think he's been a great Bond in the films that I've seen. I think, as Adam's saying, he's kind of changed the franchise in ways that have made it a lot more serious, a lot more emotional. You know, people think he's like this emo Bond, where, you know, the story's kind of got a bit darker with him, and it's sort of, you know, referred more to his like personal history. And in many ways, it feels to me like that this era of Bond has been very heavily influenced by the way that like television has changed over the last few years, and the way that serialized dramas have become, you know, like much darker and much more kind of, even in the aesthetic as well. I think like the kind of shadowy look and the feel of these last Bond films has been very consistent with the kind of television dramas that we've seen recently too. So I think this was a really good send off for Daniel Craig, as Adam said. I just don't know if I buy the means by which they got there. I had a lot of issues with, as I say, like the villain. I mean, as Adam says, that this film kind of tries to correct some of the sort of Spectre arc that they've set up in these previous films, which is, I think, sort of ended quite conveniently in No Time to Die. It's quite a rapid conclusion, I would say, to that part of the story, which maybe, you know, has more build up from the other films, but for a standalone film, I don't know if it necessarily had the payoff that it really should have. Yeah,
I mean, that is the most unsatisfying. If you've been invested in like the Spectre arc, it's a kind of like Thanos click style, like, oh, don't worry about that anymore, that's gone, right. Like, we're just gonna carry on and yeah. But I think that the thing with the Craig era is that people tend to think of it as really gritty and like you said, Caitlin, very dark and edgy, and it definitely is overall. But this film, interestingly, is a lot more. It's a real like hugs and kisses Bond movie.
It's very romantic, I would say.
It's very romantic.
It's a very romantic Bond film, yeah.
Very very romantically shot as well.
Yeah,
like the way it's lensed, the cinematography. You know, there's a lot of kind of magic hour stuff in there. The whole thing is very. Well, by and large, I'd say it's very, yeah, very romantic. It paints this kind of picture of a guy, I guess, where in this sort of very traditional, like John Ford Western mold, he is this kind of like John Wayne riding into the sunset kind of character. And there's a lot of iconography, which I think is trying to encourage you to go along with that. And you know, I guess we should talk about the stuff that happens in this movie a little bit without obviously spoiling it.
I suppose spoiler territory.
Yeah, it's hard.
Hashtag no time for spoilers. But yeah, I mean, Michael, you I don't think have had a chance to see this, right?
I haven't yet, no.
So definitely wouldn't want to kind of ruin anything for you either. But yeah, I think it's interesting that talking about the kind of emotional or personal aspect of it, one of the things with this film, which definitely carries on from kind of Spectre, is Madeleine Swann, played by Léa Seydoux, is much more prominent in this film. And actually, the film begins with a bit of a prologue and of where kind of her and Craig were left off. And Bond's sort of in this more like, you know, he's basically out of the service, retired. And then she really plays a more prominent role. Their relationship is like the through line of this movie, basically. And I don't know whether, I mean, Caitlin, have you seen Casino Royale?
Yeah, I've seen Casino Royale and Skyfall.
Yeah, so Casino Royale sets up Vesper Lynd, played by Eva Green, as like the big romantic love interest. And it's interesting that the film kind of calls back to her in a really strange way, I think. Which I think may alienate people who aren't necessarily still hung up on the Casino Royale plotline, and maybe just want to enjoy the kind of Seydoux Craig romance that's going on in this. And Yeah, I sort of said it would be funny if they just did a kind of like Broken Flowers, him going around visiting all his exes. Yeah. But
though, it's like hard to buy into the romantic sort of, you know, drama between Craig and Seydou when at the beginning of this film he's visiting, you know, the grave of his past love and like is clearly still quite hung up on her. And it's like the everlasting problem with James Bond is that, you know, it's just woman after woman, isn't it? So why should we ever believe that he really is like affectionate towards someone more so than anyone else? I don't know.
Just to quickly add, because I know we've got to get onto scores, but I think talking about the kind of women in this film and looking at the ways that Bond has made progress as a franchise, and I think the real star of this film is Lashana Lynch, who comes in and she's introduced, and this isn't a spoiler. I think this has very much been kind of pushed by the film and the production and the marketing, but she is kind of introduced as the new MI6 kind of hotshot agent. She's got the iconic code number, which Bond has obviously like relinquished, and their dynamic is great. I think they kind of fizz and spark off each other really well. I think the film unfortunately undoes a lot of the good work it's trying to do by introducing her and potentially setting up a kind of post Craig, post Bond era for the franchise. And it's, yeah, I found it really frustrating the way her character is kind of made to pay deference to Bond in like a really like cringy way. So I think she's really great. I'd love to see her in a more prominent role going forward. I don't know about the other characters though. I feel like I know that the M's and Q's and all these sort of supporting roles have always been there, but they just feel really tired now. Yeah. Even those characters, like they try to give sort of Ben Whishaw a little bit more backstory here, but it's like it just, yeah, didn't really work for me.
Oh, that's a shame to hear. I quite liked in Skyfall and Spectre where they started to bring in a bit of a influence from Mission Impossible, where it became more of a team movie. But that's a shame. Oh gosh. Okay, but let's put some scores on it, right, to wrap up No Time to Die, otherwise we'll be here for 6 years talking about it. Adam, I'll come to you first. This is In Anticipation, Enjoyment in Retrospect.
Yeah, and you can read more in my review yeah, which is on the website.
It's a very good review. I like how you go through all the milestones that have happened in before this film had even come out. Like yeah, the song winning a Grammy 6 months before the film's even been released.
I mean, that's got to be a first, right? Billie Eilish, I mean, her song came out 18 months ago. And I mean, actually, credit to it, because when it comes on during the opening credits, it doesn't feel old at all. It's like, oh, that's a quite a fresh, decent. I think it's like one of the better Bond songs of the Craig era. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's better than like Chris Cornell and, absolutely, I mean, Sam Smith, Christ. But anyway, I'd say five for anticipation. I gave it a two in enjoyment, and that's maybe a little bit unfair in that it, you know, it does deliver on the kind of big moments, the big action. I just thought, like kind of Caitlin alluded to, it's a little bit clumsy in terms of the overall story and how it gets to where it's trying to get to. But I think ultimately it is a really nice send-off for Craig. And I don't necessarily begrudge the film giving him that time in the spotlight and letting him kind of ride off into the sunset, because I think he has been like a really good kind of torchbearer for the whole franchise.
And Caitlin, what scores do you give this?
I'm going to go one fewer than Adam in anticipation, just because, you know, I was excited for it. You know, it's a Bond film. I'm very happy to engage with that whole world. And I very much knew what I was getting in for, so there wasn't really going to be any kind of surprises here. I was like very, very much expecting what it was going to be and what it was. So I'd say a four in anticipation. I did have a good time watching this. I'll happily give this a three. For enjoyment, and you know, yeah, I did have problems with the kind of the logistics of the plot, but then at the same time, you know, you can't really necessarily apply logic to sort of megalomaniac villains in Bond movies, which is fair enough. Yeah, I think I agree with Adam on some of the issues around the women characters in the film, and wish that a bit more could have been done there. But at the same time, you know, around this whole debate about women and Bond, I think women can aspire to be much more than James Bond, to be honest. So I'm happy to leave that where it is. And yeah, maybe a three also in retrospect. I'm not going to bash it too much. I think it was a great send off for Craig, as Adam says. And yeah, there was lots to just sit back and enjoy, really, and have fun with. So yeah, happy to give it a three.
Absolutely. And Caitlin, so Adam said Jack Loudon for next Bond. Do you have a take on who should pick up the tuxedo next?
I mean, I can see that Jake has offered Henry Golding in our little chat here, which I think is actually quite a good shout. He definitely would fit the bill, I think. It's just not something I mean, you could probably put any of these like current young lads in that role. You know, I've seen like Joe Alwyn being thrown about, Dev Patel. You would just kind of hope that, you know, they are able to, you know, really change the writing, I think, is what actually matters. And, you know, the character can kind of be absorbed by anyone, I think. But to really give it a boost and a newness and an excitement, I don't think it's about having a woman Bond or anything like that. I think it's about just doing something more interesting with what the franchise can do and can offer.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mm-hmm. Who'd be your second or third pick, Adam, behind Jack Loudon, or is that the only one you'd be happy with?
No, I'm Jack all the way. No, I don't know. It's funny because I think with Bond, I mean, you know, if you look at kind of who's leading the way in the odds with the bookies, it's like, it's still like Idris Elba and people like that, which you know, would have been great 10 years ago. But you look at it now and it's like, well, Craig's in his kind of 50s. They're probably not going to make another film at least, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years. So by that time, if you want to give someone a good run at it, a good like decade, which generally I think that's what they're looking to do now, unless someone ends up just being like really bad and a film tanks, you know, I think they'll be looking for like a longer run. So yeah, you've got to be looking at someone who is in that younger bracket, probably like around the 30 mark. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, people talk about Richard Madden's sort of another name which comes up a lot. I don't mind that. I would quite like it to be someone who's a bit more suave and a bit more urbane. I don't know. I would quite like to see a bit of a return to like the Brosnan Brosnan era. I think for what it's worth, I think Brosnan is not necessarily in the context of the films that he's in and how they play out, but in terms of how he inhabits the role, it's probably the closest to like the Fleming, if you read any of the books, it's like closest to like the Fleming idea of Bond.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are so many suggestions we could go through, and sure, listeners, I'm sure you have plenty to suggest as well. So let us know what you make of No Time to Die and what you make of the question of who should play Bond next, if you care about such things, at the usual channels, at LWLies on Twitter, truthandmovies at tcolondon.com via email. Up next, we're going to a much smaller scale film, although featuring the sort of stunt you might find in a Roger Moore James Bond film. We have Anne at 13,000 feet.
Thank you.
Anne has a seemingly stable life as a daycare worker, but after skydiving for her best friend's bachelorette party, the ground shifts beneath her feet. The pressures of her daily life threaten to overwhelm her. When she meets Matt, she begins to push the limits of what's socially acceptable. So, Caitlin, this was a festival film, Toronto. Was that actually a year or two ago now? Is this another long-delayed release?
Yep, 2019 I saw this film in Toronto. And now I'm really pleased that it's finding a home on Mubi here in the UK, because I think it's just a really great example of a small-budget indie movie that's just well worth everyone's time, to be honest.
Can you tell us a little bit more what to expect for this film? Because, of course, it's quite low budget, it's quite subtle, it's quite short as well, like 70-odd minutes. Very much this character study, I suppose. What should we expect?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny to talk about this in the context, well, in relation in some ways to a James Bond film, because, you know, it couldn't be further from a Bond film, but equally the kind of tension and the pressure and the stress that it kind of induces may be similar to, you know, fight scenes in James Bond or action sequences. It's very high pressure. As you say, it's quite a small character study. It's just about this woman, Anne, who is, you know, seemingly suffering with some kind of anxiety disorder or a kind of mental illness that goes undiagnosed throughout the film. But we just see her kind of trying to navigate her life and trying to navigate situations at work. She works at a daycare, which I think is a really fascinating kind of microcosm for the world at large, really. You know, the types of interactions you have there, the way that, you know, people clash and you know, children are trying to grow and learn and sort of, you know, come up against one another. So it's really interesting that that's the sort of the central setting. But then she also goes to a wedding. You know, she introduces her new boyfriend to her family in this very like chaotic scene. It's just these kinds of little moments of her life that are really kind of becoming very tumultuous and very hard to control, despite what, you know, seems to be their simplicity, because of this sort of, you know, inner sort of torment that she's facing. It's very similar, I think, in lots of ways to the work of John Cassavetes, if people are familiar, with films like A Woman Under the Influence, in the same way that Gina Rowlands in that film is just this kind of like, you know, ball of sort of tragic energy in lots of ways. And she's incredibly expressive. She's incredibly, you know, interior in her performance. Dara Campbell in Anne at 13,000 Feet is also kind of operating in that way, trying to get out what's sort of inside her and how that causes the sort of havoc and the chaos around her. And the film is, yeah, very, you know, shot very, very closely and very kind of claustrophobically in lots of ways to also convey that really, really just impressively controlled, but also loose and sort of flowing in a way that really gets to the heart of this character's like interior turmoil. Just a really great example of like low budget filmmaking, I think. Mm-hmm. Well worth your time, and it's, as you say, it's only 75 or so minutes, just a really powerful example of performance, you know, camera work, storytelling very like tightly controlled space and setting.
Yeah, reading reviews of this, it sounds like Dara Campbell is a bit of a triple threat. Also co-wrote and associate producer on this as well as starring in. So one of those sort of festival discoveries where we should look out for that name in the future.
Yeah, well, she's really great. She's also been in a lot of the work by another Canadian filmmaker, Sophia Bodanowitz, which is maybe harder to seek out. But if you do get a chance to see some of it, her work is much kind of softer in some ways than this film. But Dara Campbell is just such a central force in the middle of all of these works. And real, real kind of emotional power, I think, she brings to her performances. So she's definitely one to watch.
Absolutely. So what scores would you give Anne at 13,000 Feet?
I would say my anticipation, I didn't know much about the filmmaker. I didn't know, at the time, didn't know much about Dara Campbell. I'd say going into this, you know, it was maybe a 3 because it just sounded interesting. I'm always interested in films about kind of, these kind of focus studies on women and people kind of going about their daily lives in that way. So maybe a 3. And then I'd say 4 and 4 for enjoyment and retrospect. I think it's just really impressive. As I said, really kind of great example of what you can do on a low budget and in a short time span. And, you know, you can create as much intensity and pressure as a Bond action movie, and you can, you know, you don't have to have a, you know, repetitive fight scenes, you know, over and over again. It's the same, creating the same kind of tension and emotion in very unique and sort of more subtle ways, I think.
And a great reminder that Bond isn't the only film out this weekend. It may seem like exactly. That when you look at the listings, and there are 50 screenings of it every hour in your listings, but it's so great to hear that there is a nice gem out there on MUBI to watch. So listeners, maybe if you fancy something other than No Time to Die, of course there are other films out too, but And at 13,000 Feet is on MUBI. But up next we have Film Club, and it's back to Bond-ish for the non-canonical Never Say Never Again. Bit of synopsis for Never Say Never Again before we get into the production background as well, because we need to set this up. But first of all, Sean Connery returns to face the greatest challenge of his Secret Service career, threatening global destruction by cruise missiles. Arch-villain Maximilian Largo is holding the free world to ransom, and M is forced to put semi-retired Commander James Bond back in action with his 007 license renewed. So Adam, you're not a Bond head, but you've probably watched this, you know about the backstory behind this. So this is coming out of the fact that there was competition over who owned the rights to the story of Thunderball, because the script for that was written, and then there were multiple writers, and then one of them got the rights to remake only Thunderball, and with certain elements of the Bond story that they owned. So the thing that I found out on this rewatch of Never Say Never Again is that Eon, who make all of the main Bond films, lost the rights to Blofeld and Spectre in the 70s. So this is until the author of all, James's Payne, Christoph Waltz, turns up in Spectre. This is the only appearance of Blofeld and Spectre on screen. Came out the same year as Octopussy, later in the year, very much Battle of the Bonds. And they brought back decrepit, age-old Sean Connery, who actually at this stage is the age that Daniel Craig is now.
And also was younger than Roger Moore was in Octopussy.
Absolutely. Wow. I didn't realise this. So Connery is three years younger than Moore.
Yeah.
But I suppose Sean lost his hair earlier.
Yeah, exactly. So, a bit more on the backstory. So when Fleming obviously died quite young, and kind of before, I think he'd finished what he was trying to do with Bond, he was kind of looking at doing a film. They didn't actually think that they were going to use one of the existing stories. They wanted to write a new story just for the film. And he brought in Kevin McClory and Jack Whittingham, and they sort of worked up a screenplay. It never got made at that time. But Fleming then went away and basically wrote Thunderball, adapting this existing screenplay, and didn't credit either McClory or Whittingham, and it became this kind of legal battle. I think basically him and McClory fell out, or there was some kind of issue about not wanting to use or have McClory as a kind of producer on the film. And so he went away and wrote Thunderball, and ultimately McClory retained some kind of writing credit and you know the license to go and make a film based on that story. So, I mean, Never Say Never Again is kind of talked about as like a remake of Thunderball, and it is to a large extent, but it is also very much its own thing, and it's a fascinating film. I think we talked about all the iconography and the kind of I guess like the cliches that you associate with Bond, and one of the great things about this film is that it doesn't have any of that, and I don't know how much of that was like a rights issue, but like, for example, you know, there's no like gun barrel walk-on intro. It has the kind of theme song, but the theme song is like a bit of a refrain throughout. It doesn't have the kind of big opening sequence like, you know, the films of the 60s and 70s kind of pioneered. You obviously have Connery returning, and they definitely play up that aspect of like, it is one last job, and he's kind of a bit over the hill, and maybe a little bit like out of step with the modern world. I mean, there's an amazing scene which is a bit of a kind of callback to the Casino Royale like poker game, where he's playing a video game against the villain, which is like, I mean, it's a pretty bad scene. When you look at it now, it's like, it doesn't really have much tension to it, but but it's quite fascinating. Like that's where Bond was at that time, and that's where these films kind of were. And actually, I think in some ways it's aged better than Octopussy.
Mm-hmm.
And Connery just, I mean, you know, he just knows exactly what he's doing with his character. Obviously, he had this big gap between, I think, is it Diamonds of Forever was, I think, the last proper one he did. So it's a good, like, 12-year gap or something. And it's a long time, that, you know, to be away from the character. But the fact that he just kind of walks back on and delivers this performance, I mean, it's like, he's partly, like, phoning it in, but it's just great. I think he's just great. And this film is, like, generally regarded as one of the worst Bonds, and obviously non-canonical. But I actually think it's got a lot of merit, and it's good fun. I mean, it doesn't take itself as seriously as something like No Time to Die. And I mean, God, I would absolutely love it if No Time to Die had ended on like a freeze frame wink to the camera, as this does. I mean, that would have been like the ultimate like sign off for Craig, I think. But
it really is funny how it plays almost like a parody of Bond at times, and Connery is so magnetic a screen presence. So he just pull you through all of this. But Edward Fox as M is being played as this sort of kind of satirical politician figure rather than the sort of stalwart military men of old. Similarly, when we have it's Rowan Atkinson as the MI6 agent that is sort of tailing him all the way through in a very madcap slapstick kind of way. Sean Connery brought in Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenet of Porridge and Likely Lads fame to punch up the writing. Apparently, the majority of the screenplay that they actually shot was written by them, which probably explains that it's quite jokey and comic. And I think that's the part that might have aged the worst. But what is fascinating about this is almost looking in a Hall of Mirrors style at what Bond in the early 80s could have been, because they really did try and figure out who would be the right people to make a Bond movie. They get Irving Kirshner off the back of Empire Strikes Back. The majority of the production team, design, cinematographer, etc., have just come off Raiders of the Lost Ark. So great talent behind the camera, but it's a very inert film overall for me. You say, Adam, that Sean Connery just walks on screen. He mostly is just walking and maybe does a punch every now and then.
this is the thing that I don't know whether this was just a result or consequence of the fact that Connery was a bit older and couldn't do certain stunts and things. I mean, there's one amazing sequence, which is a motorbike chase sequence, which actually it's an interesting parallel to No Time to Die, which has a similar scene. I think is you know, obviously that has a lot more like trickery and some sort of more impressive shots in terms of the setup. But I think this is just as like exciting. But generally speaking, like you say, Bond is kind of operating at a much slower pace in this. And I actually kind of like that. I mean, Craig is constantly rushing around. You know, you never see Craig like eating an apple. Like in this, Connery is just kind of strolling around and sort of things happen in the moments in between the action where he's just, you know, eating an apple, walking into a room, and then, someone's gone missing or something's happened. And I quite like the way that it plots that out, and it's it just feels a little bit more, it's just a bit more of a relaxed film, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But
Caitlin, what did you make of this?
Well, I mean, I'd heard that this is like considered the worst Bond, or you know, non-canonical Bond film, but I actually had a really good time with this film. I think it's like, It's shameful, you know, like what they got away with, like at that time. Like these movies just kind of didn't care, like the sort of like groan worthy comments that they make to women, or like, you know, the sort of pithy one liners that Bond has. Like they just, you know, they got away with it all. And in some ways, this film, and I think No Time to Die, like as you're saying, Adam, there are a lot of like weird parallels. I think, you know, there's like the guy with the like electronic eye, or like the bionic eye is the same in both. Even down to the fact that like Bond in No Time to Die, he's kind of giving off this weird like anti-millennial vibe, and like he's kind of not with the times, and he sort of doesn't want you know, like these new things to come through. And there are certain comments where I thought like, oh, that's like kind of weird to hear a Bond character say. And yeah, like Sean Connery is clearly kind of past it at this point in Never Say Never Again, but it still kind of works. And I think for me, somewhere in the middle of those two films is like my ideal Bond movie, because Never Say Never Again has this like kind of incredible like grandeur and like sense of fun to it through things like costume, through like these small moments like Adam's talking about, you know, where he's like eating an apple and then he like shoves it down on this like statue that has like a spike pointing out of it. And it has like these great visual moments where, you know, the actor is like doing kind of acrobatics on a surfboard, and like she kind of flies and lands in front of Sean Connery, and it's very silly, but there's also something kind of great about how it looks visually and how, you know, how sort of fun and grand it was. But then at the same time, you know, as I say, like it's, you know, just kind of the commentary on women and the sort of old fashioned humor in lots of ways, like doesn't necessarily work. But I do think there's lots about this that's very fun. It's, you know, more adventurous in a way than these like newer Bond films, which kind of, as I was saying before, like are following this almost like television formula where, you know, they're trying to like hit all these emotional beats for an audience and have this aesthetic that's been like very common in what we've been seeing on our screens. Whereas those kind of older films are slightly freer and they're just like having fun and doing lots of interesting things. Like I absolutely love the last scene when Kim Basinger is wearing that like tiger swimsuit. Like it's just stuff like that is actually really great visually. And it's very fun and just like just great to watch. I also loved that this film had a fight scene with sharks. And like the ridiculous moment where he just like closes a door on a shark. Like what on earth? But it's kind of great.
I still have no idea how they film that.
No, yeah, I was thinking this. I was like, how did they even do that? Like he just fully shuts a door on a shark. It's great.
Well, that's Never Say Never Again. this is one where the production backstory is so good and there's so many great bits of trivia. You know, Adam, you mentioned Sean Connery getting back into battle shape, and that was Steven Seagal was his trainer back then. There's also one trivia tidbit on IMDb, which you should always take with a grain of salt. This is the last time Sean Connery was clean shaven on the big screen.
Beautiful. Wow. And with a full head of hair, it's probably as well.
Miraculous head of hair. But yes, that's Never Say Never Again, listeners. Let us know. Is this the worst Bond film? Is it a hidden gem? Should it be reappraised? Let us know at the usual channels, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or via Twitter at LWLies. Next week, we're not doing a conventional episode with new releases because on the 6th of October, the London Film Festival starts. We're going to be doing a preview episode with some of our highlights from the programme. Listeners, please subscribe wherever you pod. If your podcast player of choice lets you leave reviews, we'd love you to leave one for us too. That's it for this week. We'll see you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.